This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
In today's lecture, we have two speakers discussing Frederick II of Prussia and his checkered relationship with the 18th century public sphere. They will reconstruct how the king and his collaborators tried to control the reception of his literary oeuvre and hence his reputation. Our first speaker, Shiro Lim, is an intellectual historian and a fellow at the Aarhus Institute of Advanced Studies. In her talk, she will focus on Frederick's Anti-Machiavel. Published in 1740, this work was, and indeed still is, best known as a manifesto for virtuous kingship. But it is important to remember that this reaction was deliberately orchestrated by Voltaire. In the second part, Avi Lifshitz will talk about a different work by Frederick II, the Œuvre du Philosophe de Sanssouci. This selection of poems had long circulated only among the king's confidants. However, during the Seven Years' War, the French government arranged its publication to expose the Prussian ruler as an irreverent and irreligious author. Lifshitz works as an associate professor of history at the University of Oxford, where he is a fellow of Magdalen College and academic program director of the Voltaire Foundation. But first, we will start with Shiro Lim.
Before I'd like to start, I'd like to thank Pascal for the invitation and for making all the arrangements for today's event, as well as for the German Historical Institute too, for this forum and for proposing the very interesting format. I've never done a joint lecture before, and I genuinely cannot think of better company to do my first ever one with. My only gripe is that circumstances continue to prevent us from doing things like this in person. In any case, today Avi and I are going to talk about various things concerning this man, Frederick II. Frederick was born in 1712 and ruled the Kingdom of Prussia from 1740 until his death in 1786. Frederick is known for many things, including the encouraging of the cultivation of potatoes in Germany, being also quite a decent flautist. This is a real picture that I took. So he also composed things as a real picture I took in 2012 in Oxford. And he's also famous for owning several Italian greyhounds. Okay, I know these are not greyhounds, but the dog is here. But as I wrote in the blurb for the event, Frederick also enjoys the reputation of philosopher king, as well as major author in his own right. Now, this is not a trivial point. Rulers, however literarily and philosophically inclined, were rarely so prolific, audacious, or ambitious in what they wrote. Frederick's literary and philosophical output, whether published or unpublished in his lifetime, is thus striking in both volume and content and has provoked plenty of scholarly work. Some of Frederick's most major writings are collected in this volume, translated by the wonderfully surnamed Angela Scholar and edited and introduced by my honorable co-speaker. Doing the kind of contextual and analytical work that Avi did there is integral to a fuller appraisal of Frederick's writings and role as an author. But so too is understanding Frederick's checkered history with an increasingly energetic and volatile 18th century public sphere. Today, we'll explore two key episodes in this history, one pivoting around 1740 and the other around 1760. Now, among scholars of Enlightenment Europe, the term public sphere invites particularly extensive historiographical meditation. In his Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere, Jürgen Habermas posited the 18th century as a pivotal period in the history of political criticism. The birth of this occurred in a space between civil society and the state, the public sphere. But if we use Habermas's original term, the place of political criticism's birth is not just the Öffentlichkeit, of course, but the bürgerliche Öffentlichkeit. And this was the result of literary Öffentlichkeiten morphing into political ones. When that evolution occurred in 18th century Europe, Habermas argued, high-profile writers like the French philosophe became arbiters of rational critical debate and of public opinion. The events that Avi and I will be talking about today occurred in precisely this period of transition. I should say that it is not my primary or secondary or tertiary purpose here to endorse or refute Habermas's account of the bürgerliche Öffentlichkeit or of the Enlightenment, and I'll get back to Frederick in a minute. There are, however, a couple of ways in which Habermas's account is directly relevant to our subject this evening, beyond the fact that the title of our event nods so prominently in his direction. Indeed, central to Habermas's story was the possibility of lots of different kinds of Öffentlichkeiten. Throughout the history of early modern and modern Europe, they range from höfisch-ritterliche, repräsentative, bürgerliche, literarische, politische, moderne, even kirchliche and großfamiliale. Now, if there's something that we can learn from this readiness to conceive of a multiplicity of publics with various memberships and functions, it is precisely that conceiving the public sphere as a monolithic entity with immutable traits seriously understates the scale of the challenge Frederick faced when his writings made their way beyond the cabinet. Part of what Avi and I want to say today has to do with the history of this challenge. Now, in my remaining time, I will talk about what I think is an important chapter in that history. The episode in question straddles the periods shortly before and after Frederick became king in June 1740. It revolves around a work called the Anti-Machiavel, about which some of you might have heard. Now, I must come clean and say that in the interest of keeping to time and staying on topic, I will, of course, grossly truncate the story of the Anti-Machiavel, focusing on highlighting the ways in which a sense of publicness came into play in various aspects of the work's history. In what follows, I aim to ask how many layers and varieties of publics are distinguishable in this story, how they're invoked, and to what ends. Let me begin with a somewhat banal point. What's the Machiavel that the Anti-Machiavel was against? Well, Niccolò Machiavelli, of course. But what was the point or impetus of writing an Anti-Machiavel? Wasn't it widely accepted that Machiavelli's advice to princes was questionable? Of course, things were more complicated than that. In early 18th century political thought, Machiavelli's name was by no means simply synonymous with the politics of deception. The turn of the 18th century saw a more sophisticated understanding of the precise nature of the challenge that Machiavelli had thrown down. Readers of The Prince saw that Machiavelli's contribution was not an argument in favor of pursuing political ends at the expense of virtue. Rather, it was a demonstration of just how difficult it was to find a genuinely practicable and durable way to keep politics moral. Now, the most influential contribution to this conversation took an extreme position. This was written by the Archbishop of Cambrai, François de Salignac de la Motte Fénelon, over here, who was also the tutor of the Duc de Bourgogne, the eldest son of the Dauphin and hence second in line to the French throne. In his Les Aventures de Télémaque, published in 1699, presented as a continuation of Homer's Odyssey, Fénelon offered a categorical rejection of self-interest in politics. He took the Augustinian view that a truly virtuous politics was out of reach. What was attainable was only a politics that was less immoral. The austerity of Fénelon's proposals proved impossible for later political writers to ignore and trebled the difficulty of constructing viable alternatives of virtuous kingship. Any public intervention on the subject had to deal with this baggage, and it was against this intellectual backdrop that the Anti-Machiavel was composed. But of course, so Frederick didn't just wake up one day and think, you know what, I'd like to write a text about the place of virtue in politics. What he did do, however, back in 1736, then a crown prince at the tender, barely post-pubescent age of a final year undergraduate student, he established a correspondence with the most celebrated man of letters of the time, Voltaire, then in his early 40s. Treating Voltaire with what seems like a naive but genuine reverence and respect, Frederick got himself somewhat of a mentor. And it was in this capacity that Voltaire was to become involved in the Anti-Machiavel project. The first documented trace of the life of the Anti-Machiavel is in a letter from Frederick to Voltaire dated 22nd of March, 1739. But it's not, in fact, in that letter, but really in the subsequent exchanges with Voltaire that the idea of writing a refutation of Machiavelli's Prince takes shape. Looking closely at their correspondence reveals a characteristically wily Voltaire influencing the shape of the project from the very beginning, inflating its importance right from the outset. So here's how it went. So to be sure, Frederick did take the first step, advertising his intention to write something on Machiavelli's Prince. But he also added that his plans were still being mulled over in his head. But then came Voltaire's response. To refute Machiavelli, Voltaire declared, was a fine plan to which Frederick ought to adhere and to execute. The work will be a study of the knowledge of man and what his duties are, and it was up to a prince such as Frederick, Voltaire concluded, to instruct other princes. This was the first of Voltaire's many successful attempts to influence the direction of the Anti-Machiavel. The second of these came only 10 days later, before Frederick even had a chance to respond. Voltaire's message here was even less ambiguous. He wrote, It is up to you to destroy the political infamy that raises crime to a virtue. The word politician signifies in its primitive origins citizen, and today, thanks to our perversity, it means deceiver of citizens. Return to it, Your Highness, its true meaning. So up to this point, I've yet to mention the word public or any of its cognates. But in insinuating on numerous occasions from the very beginning that Frederick ought to go out there and say something about virtue in politics, Voltaire was very much using the mechanism of a public as a rhetorical strategy. Frederick's response reflects not only the remarkable success of this strategy, but also the power dynamics in their relationship were at this point heavily weighted in Voltaire's favor. Echoing Voltaire's language, Frederick replied saying that he had now already started work on a work that will completely refute Machiavelli's maxims by demonstrating the opposition that is found between them and virtue, as well as between them and the true interests of princes. The work, therefore, was to be exactly as Voltaire had envisioned it. Thus began the writing of this Refutation of the Prince, which as yet bore no title. It took the form of a chapter-by-chapter analysis and criticism of Machiavelli's Prince. Frederick got to work very quickly, and the next few months saw the Crown Prince and the philosophe periodically exchanging drafts, feedback, corrections, and revisions, not unlike the writing of the doctoral thesis from which this material is drawn. Also not unlike the writing of the doctoral thesis from which this material is drawn, the author soon became deeply unhappy with its contents and wanted to disavow the work altogether. That's where the similarities end. Now, considering our topic this evening, it's particularly interesting to see what Frederick gave as his reasons for having cold feet. Nearing the end of the work's completion, Frederick told Voltaire that he thought the work spoke too freely about all the great princes, and that because of this, he ought to publish it anonymously. He then urged Voltaire to help preemptively soften the impact that the text might have, writing that he would like that if the public suspects its author, that it would not do him any harm. Frederick then reiterated his concerns about public reactions to the work again. He told Voltaire that the work was not yet worthy of being published. One needed to chew a work of this nature over and over again in order that it did not appear in an incongruous manner in the eyes of a public always predisposed to satire. So, on the first reading, one might think Frederick was simply a perfectionist or just increasingly nervous about his first published work. This is quite plausible, but there's more to it too. Frederick's emphasis on the fear of distortion shows that his was an argument stemming from more than simple perfectionism. Rather, it seems that he differentiated between a small, but more importantly, identifiable, targeted circle of readers and a broad, disembodied public. In the former, his manuscript circulated only according to his own or Voltaire's discretion. In the latter, the exercise of that discretion entirely ceased to exist. It was the imminent widening and depersonalizing of the anti-Machiavelli's readership that triggered Frederick's apprehension. Indeed, differently put, it was not the anti-Machiavelli that Frederick judged unworthy. It was its potential readership. Nevertheless, the first version of the anti-Machiavelli appeared in late September 1740 under the title Examen du Prince de Machiavel. In the meantime, Frederick's father, Frederick William I, had died and Frederick had become king. This inevitably meant a lot for the anti-Machiavelli. It was no longer the side project of a precocious crown prince, but the product of a royal hand. Things were about to get quite serious. The anti-Machiavelli's publication just showed just how difficult it was to control the reception of a published work. Unfortunately for Frederick, his concerns about the anti-Machiavelli's readership were soon to be substantiated. In its immediate reception, the work was received in two main ways. The first was characteristic of those who read little or nothing of the text, exactly what Frederick had feared. In the case of the anti-Machiavelli, these observers interpreted the anti-Machiavelli's message based on little more than its title and authorship, reducing its significance to a simple declaration of the author's general opposition towards the persistence of reason of state politics in 18th century Europe. The second way it was received was rather different. The anti-Machiavelli also found some extremely thorough and distinguished readers who read the text very closely, treating its arguments as a serious piece of political writing. I'm afraid that today I will only be looking at the first of these two ways of responding to the anti-Machiavelli. And there are good reasons for doing so beyond the interests of timekeeping and not putting to sleep those of you who don't work in intellectual history. Now, imagine a seminar audience in which those who haven't read the pre-circulated paper are in the vast majority. As we all know, those circumstances can be quite frustrating for the author of the paper and detrimental to the depth of the discussion. And questions and comments from those who didn't read the paper don't tend to be of the highest intellectual value. But the fact is that those who didn't read the paper nevertheless comprise the vast majority of the audience and are therefore vastly more influential in determining the shape of the discussion. So too was this the case in the reaction to the Anti-Machiavel. So take, for instance, one of the first reviews of the Anti-Machiavel, which appeared in the Amsterdam-based Bibliothèque Raisonnée des Ouvrages des Savants de l'Europe in November 1740. It pronounced the Anti-Machiavel a unique work. Never had there been works of philosophy, I quote, written for the use of kings that have in so succinct and so lively a manner taught them the great art of reigning as a father of their peoples, unquote. The review also noted that the Anti-Machiavel filled a significant gap in the existing body of commentaries on the prince in actually prescribing an antidote to Machiavelli's ubiquitous poison. What that poison was is never explicitly spelled out, neither was the antidote. And it doesn't take close reading to show that such comments were utter commonplaces about a politics that was anti-Machiavellian in the crudest sense, reflecting little of the actual content of the text. This was a reaction common amongst even those to whom Voltaire had made personalized deliveries of the Anti-Machiavel. One of the most revealing ones was from Cardinal André Hercule de Fleury, Archbishop of Aix and chief minister to Louis XV, an important recipient, to say the least. So Fleury was amongst one of the people to whom Voltaire had personally sent nicely bound copies of the Anti-Machiavel, feigning ignorance of the identity of the work's author. Fleury wrote back to Voltaire in admiration, in a letter so full of platitudes that it could have been written without so much as opening the book. Here he says, "As I have little free time," he starts, "I have until now only been able to read 40 or so pages. The little that I have read of the work," Fleury continued, giving quite a bit away, "is so wise, so reasonable, and contains principles so admirable that he who has proclaimed them would be worthy to command other men, provided that he has the courage to put into practice what he has written." But, especially considering the theme of the present seminar, how Fleury elaborated on what he meant by putting principles into practice was really fascinating. Keeping one's word, he argued, was the mark of a great ruler. Marcus Aurelius, the Roman Stoic emperor, Fleury said, I quote, "would not have acquired the immortal glory that he will maintain through centuries if he had not upheld by the justness of his government the fine morals on which he had given such fine lessons to all sovereigns." Now, by publishing the Anti-Machiavel, its author, Fleury says, had made a very solemn commitment with the public. Fleury's letter reads to me as rather sinister, but it also implies that the public isn't something passive, a void into which new books can be just thrown without consequence, where utterances can be made with no repercussions. At the same time, Fleury's and other reactions are evidence that what we might call a public or a public sphere is more likely to be full of snap judgments rather than careful readers. This is a salutary reminder to pause and think about what we really mean as historians when we speak of a public sphere or literate public or even a reading public. Let me now come to a close. Now, in the small slices of the history of the Anti-Machiavel that I have served to you today, I hope to have suggested that various aspects of this episode shed light on ways of conceiving a public in Enlightenment Europe. This story seems to be mostly about Frederick and Voltaire, but I want to propose that it's really more than that. Now, before I cede the floor to Avi, I wanted to make some gestures in that general direction. My main concluding point has to do with rulers and their relationship to the public sphere. When I publicized this talk on Twitter, I asked the question, what happens when rulers mess with the public sphere? If contemporary cases are any indication, the answer is, in fact, not very much. In some cases, Frederick's case was very much the same, despite several moments of awkwardness, inconvenience, and embarrassment that could stretch out even over several years, nothing was ever serious enough to knock him off the throne. One way to react to this is to feel deeply discouraged by the public sphere's inability to hold rulers to account, which, according to Habermas, is supposed to be the main value of the public sphere. In Habermas's account, the reason the 18th century is an earlier, better model of modernity is precisely the public sphere's function as a tribunal to which rulers and governments will be actually held accountable. But perhaps the idea that there should be or there is a correspondence between what happens in the public sphere and what happens to political power is ultimately a false one. After all, neither political power nor authority is derived from the public sphere, and the public sphere is not where sovereignty or constituent power resides. While the public sphere can make a ruler's life very difficult, it takes a lot more than the public sphere to take a ruler down. Histories like that of the anti-Machiavel, I think, ought to prompt us to reconsider what we mean by accountability and what really is within the remit of the agency of a public or various publics. For further reflections on some of these themes, I think it's time I pass the virtual microphone to Avi.
We will now continue with the second part of today's lecture.
I'll jump right in. Having just listened to Shiro's talk, you may think that Frederick would have done a quick damage assessment in the early 1740s and just stopped writing, stopped publishing. Why the hassle of writing so much, a preoccupation beneath the dignity of a hereditary monarch, if it exposed one to unnecessary reputational risk of the sort that Shiro has just very broadly outlined? Frederick, however, did not want to forsake his favorite pastime, and yes, I would suggest that he liked writing and rhyming even more than playing the flute. Well aware of some of the problematic aspects of this activity, the king opted for a solution that he believed would ensure him against episodes such as the publication of the Anti-Machiavel and the subsequent Critical Storm, because there, at the end of the day, Voltaire basically gave the manuscript to the publishers in Amsterdam, more or less against Frederick's wishes, or at least Frederick had absolutely no control over the way in which the Anti-Machiavel finally saw the light of day. So the better to maintain total oversight over the production and circulation of his own writings, Frederick set up in the late 1740 a small printing press in a wing of the city palace in Berlin. The first item to be printed there in mid-1749 was the mock epic Le Palladion. It's quite a long work that basically plays on a scene from the Silesian Wars, where Austrian agents tried to kidnap the French ambassador to Prussia. Of course, I mean, during the First Silesian Wars, France was Frederick's ally against Austria, unlike the later Seven Years' War. Anyhow, Frederick just uses this episode and makes out of it a fictional burlesque sort of novel in rhyming lines. This was then reprinted as the first volume of the Œuvres de Philosophe de Sanssouci, dated 1750, in three volumes, where volumes 2 and 3 of this 1750 edition contained further occasional pieces, mostly odes or rhymed poems dedicated to Frederick's close friends. The edition was lavishly adorned with engravings, but unfortunately not a single copy of this very limited edition survives today, following the destruction of the Hohenzollern palaces in the Second World War, and because of the way that Frederick controlled and managed the circulation of the edition. In summer 1750, upon Voltaire's arrival at Potsdam, where he would stay until 53, he was entrusted with correcting and improving the original edition, which resulted in 1752 in a new single-volume edition of the Œuvres de Philosophe de Sanssouci without Le Palladion. Frederick did not intend the poems to reach anyone beyond his confidence, his very close small circle of confidence, because some of the odes and the epistles included risque references to political figures, to church fathers, and attacks on Christian morality, as we shall see. The circulation of the oeuvre among a very limited set of readers hinged on the recipient's acceptance of a virtual contract, we might say. They would enjoy exclusive access to the king's writings as long as they kept these works for their own eyes. This discretion also allowed the king's writings to function as marks of social exclusivity and proximity to power. To be the recipient of a dedicated philosophical poem by Frederick or a rare copy of Frederick's writing could reflect a higher degree of royal esteem than the traditional privileges in the court hierarchy or the state administration. Among the known recipients of printed exemplars of this sort of very, very limited set of printed exemplars were the president of the Berlin Academy, Maupertuis, whose widow duly returned his copy to Frederick upon his death in 1759, and also Voltaire, Francesco Algarotti, and other confidants. It's very important that Frederick set very explicit rules. If you leave Prussia, if you leave even Potsdam, or if you die, your copy must be returned to him personally. In a letter to Marquis Valory of March 1750, Frederick apologized for not sending him the first volume of the Œuvre de Philosophe de Sanssouci, explaining that he was worried about the potential responses of politicians offended by his criticism, theologians slighted by his irreligion, or linguistic purists alarmed by a German poet writing in French. All in all, Frederick complained, authors are unjustly and unfortunately judged by their works. So again, we can see here that Frederick has the public all the time at the back of his mind, and he's actually quite apprehensive of this reading public following his early experiences, such as the publication of the Anti-Machiavel. In a short apologetic poem to D'Arge, who was the protagonist of Le Paladion, Frederick asked his readers forgiveness for attributing to him some strange exploits in Le Paladion, such as being raped by a bunch of Jesuit professors. The ode, Frederick assured D'Arge, would never become public knowledge, and you can see some extracts here in the original French on the right and in English translation. So basically, as you can see in the middle, Frederick says that the poems are just a sterile compilation, child of my idleness, which will perish in obscurity. And he also promises to D'Arge towards the end that basically they will never be known publicly. This attempted separation of Frederick's public image as a philosophizing monarch from his more private persona of a leisurely poet-philosophe was also thematized in the final epistle of the Œuvre de Philosophe de Sanssouci, addressed by the king to himself under the title À mon esprit. The poem, written shortly before the printing of the Œuvre in 1750, is cast as a dialogue between the author and his soul, who tries to remind him all the time of the incompatibility between his station in life and the authorship of poems or philosophical essays. So here you can see an extract from this poem, which is included in the recent English edition of his philosophical works. And Frederick seems to be rebelling here against the judicious advice of his soul to stop writing. And you can see there in the fourth and fifth lines, must I be in my place, in the middle of my court, flattered by fools? And instead of actually writing and communicating with like-minded readers or authors, basically his confidants. And later he says, let common sense be out of season, and braving the foolish notions of my critics, I prefer above all sublime poetry. In hindsight, it may seem quite remarkable that the Œuvre de Philosophe de Sanssouci did remain for an entire decade confined to the small set of intended addressees and inaccessible to broader readership. During the Seven Years' War, however, Frederick's poems found their way into the public sphere thanks to the effort of the French government to discredit him as its enemy. The intertwining of diplomacy, politics, and philosophical authorship in this case demonstrates, I think, just how fragile Frederick's attempted division of labor between different audiences was. It also highlights how easily an image crafted for a specific circle of readers could be transformed into a rather different persona in the open public sphere. The year 1760 began with a publishing sensation. On the 17th of January, the Œuvre de Philosophe de Sanssouci appeared in Lyon, published by Bruyset, in an edition reproducing the single volume of 1752. 2 weeks later, on the 31st of January, another version under the same title was published in Paris by Saillant, based on the second and third volumes of the 1750 edition. So clearly there were two different sources to these editions who had access to the two original, very different versions of Frederick's limited editions. The rumors circulating in the 1750s about the content of the Earth, as well as the public expectation, made for insatiable demand. Both the Paris and the Lyon editions sold out within a few days and were ceaselessly reprinted and pirated by publishers across the continent. They were, of course, followed by reviews in the press and translations into various vernaculars. And here you can see the title page of one of the first editions of the Œuvre de Philosophe de Sanssouci, following the Lyon text. And contemporaries who heard about the strictly monitored access to the king's Œuvre as the Philosophe of Sanssouci were wondering what had prompted the sudden publication. letters exchanged between Frederick's friends and their contacts in Paris testify all to the surprise by which the publication took even former members of Frederick's Staffelrunde. Madame de Boucage, for example, reported from Paris to Francesco Algarotti, of course, one of Frederick's close confidants, that the newly published poems were the talk of the town. She was keen to know why and how such poems, so carefully guarded by you favorites of Frederick, have suddenly appeared in broad daylight after years of remaining secretly printed, as she put it. The commotion quickly reached Berlin, where the secretary of the Academy, Forme, wrote to Algarotti that he suspected Voltaire of having a hand in the illicit publication. Voltaire maintained a parallel correspondence with the French foreign minister, the Duc de Choiseul, to whom he delivered in 1759, despite Frederick's explicit warning, a copy of the king's ode to Prince Ferdinand, which included inappropriate references to Louis XV and to his mistress, Madame de Pompadour. But despite his initial suspicions, Frederick never explicitly blamed his close correspondent, Voltaire, because after all, Voltaire had already been arrested in 1753 by Prussian agents in Frankfurt am Main on his return journey from Potsdam, because he kept a copy of the oeuvre duly confiscated by Frederick's representatives. Beyond Voltaire, some of the suspects included d'Arget, the Duc de Nivernais, and the elusive military engineer named Bonneville, who was later in the 20th century identified by several scholars as the source of the Lyon edition. We still absolutely do not know who was the source of the slightly different Paris version. But the identity of the actual culprits is perhaps not so significant. What is important is that the classified edition was successfully leaked into the print market by a foreign power intent on damaging the author's public image. The publication was orchestrated by the French foreign minister, Choiseul, in the context of the military struggle against Prussia in the Seven Years' War, and his simultaneous offensive against the philosophe in Paris. The close relationship, of course, between the King of Prussia and members of the Parti Philosophique, such as Voltaire and D'Alembert, was no secret. After the withdrawal, for example, of the royal privilege for the publication of the Encyclopédie in 1759, Choiseul probably commissioned the satirical play Le Philosophe by Palisson, which ridiculed the editors and contributors of the Encyclopédie. Around the same time, in summer 1759, Choiseul was informed by Malesherbes, director of the Royal Censorship and Publishing Privileges, that a Parisian publisher had sought tacit approval for the publication of the Oeuvre de Philosophe de Sanssouci. The foreign minister, of course, instantly instructed Malesherbes to seize the day and publish it, introducing just a few modifications while keeping the government's involvement highly confidential. The place of publication, too, had to be disguised. And of course, this was a golden opportunity to expose the King of Prussia, an ally of the philosophe, as a promiscuous author. The hope was that the publication would undermine Frederick's self-presentation as the champion of the Protestant cause in the Seven Years' War, and thereby damage the already unstable alliance between Britain and Prussia. The king's frustration was evident in his correspondence with Voltaire throughout the year 1760, in which Frederick frequently referred to the publication of the oeuvre as an abuse of his trust, a perfidy, and a betrayal. This episode brought about one of the most serious crises in the decades-long relationship between Frederick and Voltaire. Following the publication of the oeuvre, the king wrote to his correspondents that he was enraged by the crossing of the boundary that he had tried to maintain between two kinds of audiences. Frederick said he had no issue with French attacks on him as a king and as a political enemy, but an assault on his person and his authorship, instead of direct engagement with his actions, breached the rule of the game, he thought. Frederick also complained that what he called his rhapsodies, good enough to amuse myself, as he says, had never been written with the intention of publication. And indiscriminate access to these pieces, he told Voltaire, meant that, and I quote, I have been betrayed against my will, malgré moi, in front of the public, where I will now play the role of a fool, end of quote. But Frederick knew well that complaints to Voltaire would not be enough. Realizing that he could not monitor the reception of his works, the king quickly switched into damage control mode. While he had initially tried to deny authorship and to block the distribution of the oeuvre in Berlin, he now recognized that this strategy was doomed to fail. From his winter quarters in Freiberg, the king consulted the Marquis d'Argent, his literary majordomo in Berlin. He wished above all to get rid of unflattering references to Tsarina Elizabeth and to George II of Britain, as well as to get rid of the most shocking attacks on Christianity. But how could he limit the damage given that editions of the oeuvre were already multiplying by the week? The ingenious means was a much larger, so-called authorized version designed to flood the market and crowd out all its competitors. Within 2 days, Frederick finished the task, sending d'Argent in Berlin a plan of the new edition, to which he added, among other items, a paraphrase on Ecclesiastes, meant, according to Frederick, to appease the insane zealots. The king swiftly revised the extended version, asking d'Argent in Berlin to send advance copies immediately to London and to St. Petersburg. And this revised, unloved product of the royal pen was not worthy of reflecting Frederick's persona as a poet-philosophe. The authorized version bore the simple title Poésie Diverse. And I think you can see the title page of the large edition, folio edition by Voss in Berlin of 1760. To prepare the print market for the new edition and create a sense of anticipation, d'Argent placed an announcement in the press. He repudiated the first illicit versions of the Œuvre de Philosophe de Sanssouci as completely falsified publications, where some poems were maliciously omitted and others deformed. The forthcoming Poésie Diverse, on the other hand, supposedly conformed in every way to the manuscript of its illustrious author, and we can absolutely guarantee its authenticity. That's the language of the official advertisement. This advertisement was, of course, fake news. The illustrious author himself admitted to d'Argent that the original volumes contained the legitimate children of his mind, while the authorized edition included only their bastards. While the printing presses in Berlin were churning out the authorized edition, Frederick and d'Argent discussed one of the most notorious poems, the epistle to James Keith, an exiled Scottish general in Frederick's service, who had died in 1758 from a fatal injury at the Battle of Hochkirch. Denying the afterlife and the immortality of the soul, this poem went well beyond the common deist version of natural religion. Frederick's epistle to Keith was an all-out attack on Christian morality. The king expressed in the poems his explicit contempt for any system of ethics that linked moral behavior to rewards and punishment in another life, which were, of course, predicated on immortality of the human soul. D'Argent noted in early 1760 that Calvinist preachers in Amsterdam had already condemned this radical poem, and Voltaire made a very similar point about the reaction of Calvinist pastors in Switzerland. This Protestant commotion really worried d'Argent, who suggested, while other parts of the revised version were being printed, a quick correction, because after all, it was important to keep the Protestant on Prussia's side. In the original poem, Frederick had condemned craven Christian, lâche chrétien, who acted properly only because they feared eternal torment in hell. D'Argent now suggested the urgent change of craven Christians, those lâche chrétiens, into timid mortals, mortels craintifs. And you can see the reasons here in this very interesting letter. D'Argent writes to Frederick, one must absolutely remove the word Christians. It would outrage all of imbecile Europe, of which enlightened Europe does not make the hundredth part. You have the probity, courage, and enlightenment of the Roman Emperor Julian, but when he treated Christians as cowards, three quarters of the empire was still pagan. Today, there isn't a single man from Lisbon to Arkhangel who does not see himself as Christian. If I, who have the honor of being vicar general in the sect of your majesty, find this word too harsh, consider how it would affect the mind of a Catholic or a zealous Protestant, says d'Argent. On the 9th of April, d'Argent proudly wrote to the king that a new edition had been fully printed, attaching a copy with the suggested change of craven Christians into timid humans. Frederick's own preference, craven humans, lâche humain, had arrived too late, and only later print runs included the king's preferred phrasing of human weakness. In these further editions, the Epistle to Keith also received a new subtitle, An Imitation of the Third Book of Lucretius. And I think that this reference to Lucretius's De Rerum Natura was yet another step in the bastardization of the poem, an attempt to distance the royal author from his anti-Christian poem by introducing it as a mere exercise in literary paraphrasing. As in the case of the Anti-Machiavel, the initial publication was quickly followed by new editions, pirated ones, translations into several languages, and so on. Once again, the King of Prussia found himself a best-selling author against his will, alternately attacked, refuted, and celebrated in the public sphere. I am afraid, I think, Pascal, I reached the limit of my time. So if I have just, I don't know, one or two more minutes, I would say two more words. The epistle to Keith also achieved the ambiguous distinction of being placed twice on the Catholic Index of Prohibited Books, in 1760 as part of the Œuvre de Philosophe de Sanssouci, and in 1767 as a self-standing pamphlet also translated into Italian. It also attracted public refutation across Europe, precisely as the French government had hoped. One fascinating example discussed in a longer version of this paper is a review by Moses Mendelssohn in Berlin. The Jewish author, whose residence in Prussia completely depended on the king's grace, reprimanded Frederick and tried to save the king from himself by buying, so to speak, the fiction that the epistle to Keith was just a reworking of the third book of De Rerum Natura. This episode, I think, demonstrated once again the extent to which Frederick lost control over the reception of works that he had not intended for public consumption. And this happened not only in foreign languages and abroad, but also in German and within the confines of his own capital. So what can these two episodes that Shiro and I have discussed this evening tell us about Frederick the Great and the public sphere? As crown prince and later king, Frederick wished to play a very active role in the public discussion that was stoked by the philosophe, having been introduced to the scene by Voltaire, as we heard from Shiro. Initially, such involvement necessitated anonymity, as in the case of the Anti-Machiavel, or the surveillance of a small set of select copies and addresses, as in the case of the Œuvre de Philosophe de Sanssouci. But before too long, Frederick learned that a king could not expect to remain anonymous, and his writings could not be the preserve of a tightly regimented group of readers. So I would conclude by suggesting that eventually, Frederick shrewdly transformed his initial resentment of the unregulated and unregulatable print market into a tenet of his own philosophy. He came to present in his later works the uncontrollable character of the public sphere as an informal check on his political conduct. Well aware of his unique role as a writing and publishing monarch, Frederick mobilized open criticism to his advantage by arguing that it was a logical extension of the freedom of belief and expression enjoyed by his subjects. For Frederick, only public opinion, a significant phenomenon, of course, in the second half of the 18th century, could constrain the utterances and actions of rulers, not any formal institution or political entity limiting his ultimately authoritarian rule. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.